Blog Talk Radio.
I swear to you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Masonic Effects. You caught me in a weak moment of I was thinking that if, you know, the joy, if everybody thought the way I did, if everybody was agreeable with me, wouldn't that be just a horrible existence? I'd be packing my bags right now and leaving you. I can't imagine something more tedious than being around people that think the way I do. Oh, you know, it's the variation. I'm a sucker for it. I love the variation. I love being able to understand the world through your eyes, through to see what your values are, or knowing whether you have you're a man of character, knowing whether you have some sense of self-awareness. Those things are wonderful. I prefer, you know, over the years, you know, I find that I prefer, for the most of the time, I prefer being around people that have an ability to take themselves seriously from time to time. Oh no, I not the kind that drone on. They just, oh, you know, I want to open a vein and get into a hot bath. That's like, nothing is more painful. But I like people that have that, you know, that just that sense, you know, the sense of purpose. I find that wonderful, and especially like the hearing having people share some of their idiosyncrasies, like the things that they enjoy, not with that self-conscious kind of, you know, hiding. You know, we don't want to admit that we like something that somebody out there might consider feminine, or somebody out there might consider soft. Well, are you really? Where did you ever get that? You know, you're thinking that the world is that men are born with a set of fatigues and some kind of automatic weapon in their hands. Well, maybe in some countries, but I think worldwide we're better than that. We're beyond that, but some places that's absolutely necessary. You know, you have to stand up and defend what's going on. But we do all of that for a point. I don't think that's our nature. I don't think I'll ask you, are we as tribal as we want to deny? Are we sort of stuck? When you say, Dale, you know, we're at the end of the day, we still think tribally. I'm all liberalized up, and I'm open-minded, but at the end of the day, you're still tribal. Well, my tribe expanded, and I think you know, if you ask me how that happened, I can't really tell you. I think it had to do with two things. You know, the simple things, experience and learning. And this idea of a global community, at first I just say, this is nonsense, you know. And I remember my friend from a Persian fellow that I met in school, who talked with me about you know, space law. And I thought, oh, this is absurd. You know, what is going on? And it's quite legitimate. You know, it's necessary. When you look up there, all around us, there's need to anticipate, need to think ahead. And I found that I wander into conversations and into places where there's a lot of that, where there's a lot more of an expression of anticipation. I had the good fortune to work in some very high-level research laboratories. Well, you know, put yourself the right place at the right time, or people like this kind of personality. And I wasn't specifically trained in that science, but I'm intelligent enough that I'm trainable. Yeah. And I was fascinated, and I'm still am fascinated by new things. So this would happen to be environmental biology and entomology specific. And hanging around with people, the people there working, were all doing their PhDs. These men and women are absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of that going around when you're talking about people that are at the edge, that are very, very well informed. There's an excitement. You don't see them. You see this energy and this intensity. You just scratch the surface. They walk around and they're just blah, blah, blah. But if you ask them what's going on, you see this excitement in their eyes. And that, I found the same kind of thing in theater. I wasn't brought up to ever think that the arts mattered. My goodness, no. Like having a library? What are you, waste of money. You know, we're absolute waste of money. Reading? Why would you waste? That's what we have televisions for. It's just blah blah blah. You know, all the time blah blah blah, and yet going through, have put it in, after being exposed to some of these differences. It's like, you know, when parents are expanding their child's sense of taste when they're little. You know, you try different foods. And some children are never given that opportunity. So what they like, what they eat is very narrow. Who's to say that's wrong? But there are a lot of people, and I think of them as having a more cosmopolitan palate. And they're exploring. Well, I have found myself fitting in with that kind of crowd. Take me to dim sum. Oh, just incredible. Take me to where they make the best sushi in the city. Oh, just. Or where I come from, we would take you down to the shore for oysters, and we would steam clams and lobster with you. No, don't put away the lemon on it. Don't even be so foolish. Why would you ruin something right out of the ocean? Don't be silly. And yeah, the hot coffee will be scalding enough that it'll take the roof off the top of your mouth. So the hospitality is different in different places. Or the grandmother that serves you this incredible pasta, you know. You know, how would her idiot grandchildren drag you in, and she's treating you like you belong there all your life. You know the type. You've had them in your own way, and we look at those, my tribe. You look at those people. Well, they're all those immigrants, eh? Well, then you find out. Well, we were those immigrants not so very long before. A couple of hundred years ago, we were lining up to try and find our place and opportunity. And then realize I grew up with these influences. I don't have to search them out. Somebody later on called it multiculturalism. I had the hardest time understanding it. And it was like somebody had to whisper in my ear, hey, Graham, that's what you were experiencing when you were growing up. Oh, now it's not proper, but I have Ukrainian and French Canadian and Russian and the Anglo kind of mixture going on, Poles, all of that was just, you know, those were accents and different types of spices that from the kitchens. And what's you learn, you become more, became more refined as life went on, in spite of myself. Excuse me, just back up there, in spite of myself. In spite of the trepidation and the insecurities, in spite of yourself, you think, what if these guys, and then somebody comes along that kind of takes a shine to you and says, you know, well, what's the difference between those people and you? Like, really, get into it. What's the difference between somebody that's enormously, pick somebody that you admire and that's enormous, you, and in your definition, we're not going to quibble over that, your definition of success and happiness, they have something. And what's the difference? Oh, they're genius. Yeah, really? Well, we went through that in the 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s, where we were screwing around with calculation of IQ. Remember those days? Then you're probably the crew that remember new math. Set theories came in. You remember that? That interesting experiment that really sort of dissolved on the vine. You know? The influences came and went, and some things stuck with some people. Now, I wish, in a way, this is where I started with you. I would think, gee, if I could do it, then anybody of you can. But it's not that simple, is it? Not ever. Because I found advantages, I made advantage, I created advantage for myself. That doesn't mean everybody would. My goodness, no. Nor should they. No. They live their own life. They live their own life and bless their hearts that they do. And the tribe that I found myself affiliating with, well, maybe it was, you know, I'm one of those people that went through a smoke ceremony years and years ago. Do you remember First Nations, Cree elders? And was brought in with many other people, many other men and women into the Iron Tribe. Don't ask. It's a good story, but it's not proper for here. You began to think, tribe? Which tribe? I like this tribe of people that are trying to get by the best way that they can. I like the people that encourage their children. I like that. I like people that respect their elders and particularly have a respect for women, not as chattel or toys, but as human beings with distinct ideas. And I love the idea that the neurology is teaching us that there's a female brain and a male brain. Well, in a way, when you learn the science behind it, makes sense. What are the implications? Well, the jury's still out of that. Work is still being going on with that. That's fascinating. We're not alone. Well, the tribe that I find myself associating with is the tribe that tend to influence me with ideas. When somebody offers me a kindness, that makes me feel, I pass that on. I carry that forward. I'm sure all of you do. when an ingenue holds the door for me and says, "You first, sir," I don't get creeped out about it. I'm thanking her. She's being very gracious. And when I was brought up, that would, you know, you were taught, ladies first, through the door. Yep. And I don't do that begrudgingly. It's just a different sense. I learned that what I feel is respectful is not always seen in the same light by others. And that's quite all right, isn't it? Along comes this whole business of Freemasonry. And hear that idea, if everybody was like me, I'd pack and leave. Masonry just whispers in your ear. We are similar, you know, and we all have these similar values at heart, these goals and needs, but we're different on the outside, aren't we? Well, you know, and then it goes ahead and and it asks me questions about metaphysics. Only it doesn't call it metaphysics because, oh, you know, can't use that word. That's you need to admit that you're smart to use a word like that. You can't do that. The idea that we are more than what is seen on the outside is fascinating. It's fascinating. And all of a sudden I began to think, gee, these people that think this way are also influential. They're influential on the likes of some mutt like me. They think this is brilliant. And then what it did was amplify something that I had discovered, like many of you, that I could learn from not only from my own experience, you know, that knowledge that comes in from your senses, knowledge that's the way it happens, and then I could learn from the experience of other people. Oh, so it is like watching other people buy that new model of car to see if the wheels fall off. You know, we've been through all of that kind of nonsense. And then deciding, well, if that one's reliable, that's probably the one for me. No, it's more than that. It's how you observe. And all of a sudden, I can learn from the ideas of other people because they wrote it down in all these books, you know, all this material. And then am I still learning what I need to learn? Well, mathematics and science and what kind of science? Well, geology and physics what was referred to, interestingly enough, in a dismissive way as the social sciences, the way we function, the way we impact our environment collectively. We can't, you know, the psychology, we don't want too much of that creeping in. Because then when we look in the mirror, we're acknowledging that there's a hell of a lot more going on than what we see. The ideas, and then who knew that all of a sudden the world's libraries would be accessible to me at the push of a button on this keyboard sitting in front of me. But my point was, rather than having my education curated, you know, a long time I go in and start debating with people when you go into a college or university and say, this is what I want to study. Well, I don't say I'm going to set the curriculum here and I'm going to set course content. No, you presume that these people are step ahead of you. And not all the case. You meet the odd, truly, in all sense of the word, savant, that are miles ahead. The son of one of our close friends who was wrote his BA and did a thesis and then was eagerly encouraged to do his PhD. The ideas were that clean, that pure. You know, when you recognize the genius amongst us and you think, oh, there's the bar. I think the bar is here, my struggle, but there's the bar. How did that translate for me? And I ask you this very sincerely. How did that come to be translated into what was going on the stage of a theater and to the movement of ballet or the musicality of opera, theatrics of opera? Don't get me wrong. The energy, that synergy of rock concerts. Well, we know the first rock concert, these big fiascos, was opera. Mm-hmm. Brought people together. We don't like to think of that now. And it was privilege. Who could afford? Well, you might say that now. Who could afford $600 for a ticket? Not me. I'm not going. And at this point, I'm not going to a mosh pit. I'm not going to be crushed against the front of a stage for 6 hours. Not going to happen. Give me a theater. Give me good acoustics and air conditioning or forget it. Yeah, you're with me so far. Yeah, I want intermission where I can go and sip a bit of champagne or a little, maybe a white wine and come back refreshed and then go out to dinner with my wife. times have changed, and so have you and I. The influences, this is when you start to define it. What's your community like? I like that kind of community of well-mannered, because it encourages me. The people with the nuanced conversation, because it encourages me. And I find that it's like additives. It's not like I have to surrender or give up something. Stupidity is always there, you know, it's not. And thoughtlessness is always there. It's never too far beyond the reach. But can you recognize that these are things that add? And when Bloody Masonry comes along and says, here, we're going to help you define contentment and happiness. Nobody ever did that before. They said, here, you know how to spell happiness. You know what it feels like. That's it. Really? Apparently not. Apparently not. There's a little, there's a lot more to it. And I'm not just talking about our philosophical perspective. No. There's a lot more to it. Whether you tip into it, whether you want it, I think if you want to achieve it, you should at least understand what it is you're going after. But the progress of the had a draw. The draw was to people that were continuously struggling, but not whining and complaining about the struggle, but putting their shoulder into it. A long time ago, yeah, I liked being around those fellas that taught you how to work, that you put your mind to it, you focused on it, and you did the best. If I'm digging a post hole, I'm going to dig it well. I'm going to pay attention to that, not what I would rather be doing. No, that's in the moment. They didn't talk about that as an Eastern philosophy. No, here we're going to dig the pole. So if you're dig a post hole, but if you're whining and complaining, it only makes it really a burden. And who the hell wants to be around you, you know, including yourself, because you hear yourself doing that constantly. Like I say, the advantage is being around people that think and have other experiences. And at the time, they have ideas that are really valuable. But being receptive to it, not everybody can. I know you've met those folks where they don't have that capacity for a lot of reasons. And there's people that make an active choice not to, which I find interesting. And then there's people that do. And out of the, close to 8 billion of us, my affiliation with that community is is being accelerated by my work in Freemasonry. And it's an absolute joy. It's the familiarity of walking up to people and not seeing them as a stranger, but understanding them. They're like us. They're not too certain. Their experiences will be different than yours and mine. May not trust us. One of the things that we can easily overcome. And that is the start for Masonic Effects today. Don't get me started. Thank you. Just a treat for the ears. These foolish things. These are a Spanish music professor, Joan Chamorro, and he puts out this music on the internet with his students. Just a treat. And thank you. And here we pick up on that. That scintillating introduction to the show, and I must stop. What caught my attention? I want to share with you something that's happened that I can't quite understand. I can't. The listeners list. Yep. We'll start with. I usually end with Canada. Thank you. The support here in Canada is just takes my breath away. We have listeners here, you, from Canada, the United States of America, the United Kingdom, Latvia, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Oman, New Zealand, China, Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. What's happened? I think this is brilliant. People tuning in. Excellent. Excellent. It's the embrace. It's that global community. I can't explain how or why people are tuning in from those countries, and it doesn't matter. Maybe it's somebody that's traveling around with their laptop, and they are from Winnipeg, and they're flying over on business, or for whatever reason. You know, the world is a smaller place than it ever was. And they open the hook up to the internet and bam, there we are. But for whatever, we are grateful for you. Here, the commentary today. the richness of ideas. I hope it fits with the intro a little bit in your mind. And King Solomon could have asked for anything. God was so satisfied with his service that he made the offer: wealth, power, land, cities, you know. But he would have none of it. Instead, he asked for an understanding heart. So what did Solomon know about wealth? The idea of understanding is oddly satisfying. Some ideas resonate, some tantalize. T.S. Eliot reminds us in his 1942 poem, Little Gidding, not known because not looked for. If you don't look for it, you can't possibly know. Learning is as easy and as challenging as looking and asking. Greece turned understanding inside out when they turned to an oracle at Delphi. And from that period, we are left with their maxims to ponder as they did. Three may be better known than the rest. Know thyself. Easier said than done, huh? Nothing in excess. What? Surety brings ruin. Oh, I realize this is the stuff of single malt, you know, and a quiet night and put on some, you know, Debussy. This is not something you rush around with. So as we, you and I, bend to our labors, we have work to do in the background just to understand. Stobatius gave up 147 of them. Be thyself, control thy temper, exercise nobility. Three I've selected at random to be shared. As many of us learning, teaching others is a good way to learn. So doesn't this suggest a good use of Delphic maxims when we are introduced to a person about masonry? Tell me your thoughts on that, you know. Control your temper. This is a maxim. What does it tell you? Would it have changed your set point to be asked what a particular maxim means to you? I know it's unfair without telling you which one. But would it have changed the set point? No declaration, just asking for an observation. No preparation for it, just an observation. As a measure of the man. Yeah. I believe we would not be speaking with him or her without also having a sense of their ability to contribute, to compromise, have a sense of tolerance, and a questioning mind, and a sense of humor. We cannot share ideas with a person who has no inclination to trust them. It is what we understand and how we apply that understanding in our constructions that sets us apart. I like to think there are brethren with a vision of cathedrals requiring generations of commitment to complete. Right you are, Cluny no longer exists except in history as a remarkable achievement. Yeah, right you are. Are we going for immortality too? What the hell? Thank you. Bill Evans. This poet, speaking of detail and the tribe, I have a sense of poetry in my head, but I'm timid about putting it into words and, you know, frightened by sharing any of that, because you know, of course you'll hate it and mock it. I project all of those shortcomings onto you. It's terribly unfair. This literary genius has been on the show before, but this is one of his poems that I find often being recited and mentioned because of the topic matter itself. This is the Musée des Beaux-Arts. This is a W.H. Auden writing a poem about art. No wonder he was an influence when he was at Oxford. This is a fellow born, 1907? He did have privilege. His father was a professor at Birmingham University. His mother was a nurse. They lived well. But he went off, and they were devoutly, the family was devoutly Anglo-Catholic. And the family name, spelled Audun, A-U-D-U-N, appears in the Icelandic sagas.
Yeah.
And Audun, they put an E in the end, inherited this from his fascination from his father, the fascination with Iceland. But at Oxford, he gained a formidable reputation. The advantage of a place like Oxford is the records and the care and detail. These are bright people, so they know how to describe things. And no, it's not comprehensive. It never is, but pretty damn good. There, he influenced some people that went on. Literary intellectual C. Day Lewis was a poet laureate in 1968. Lewis McNeice and Stephen Spender, who printed by hand the first collection of Auden's poems in 1928, printed by hand. And their names are often linked with his poet. So the so-called Auden generation, the notion of the Auden group, it was dedicated to revolutionary politics and was largely a journalistic invention. This guy became the voice of what would you call it, counterculture or left-wing thinking? Mm-hmm. You know, that where you have that academic freedom to actually challenge and to examine from the underside what the status quo. Nothing is safe. Nothing is safe. Except bring your reasoning, bring your values, bring it forward. After he graduated, his parents said, do a victory lap. And instead of Paris, he chose Berlin. Now, Berlin at the time was avant-garde. It was theater. It was music. It was the arts at a whole different level. It was a community. It was a community. Think more bohemian. And you would wonder, scratch your head and say, what the hell? What happened there? You know, things seem to go to hell. This was the place of poetry. This is Bertolt Brecht. Have you ever seen it? His work is just, it's delightful, delightful. At cabaret and plays and that was his victory lap. And then he came back to be a schoolmaster in Scotland and England for the next 5 years. You know, payback show. You do something with your degree and your education. And then he was writing. We're going to stop there. You can read it on if you want. There's tons of material about this guy. He was the hero of the left pre-World War II. Should we have listened more to this? Well, you know, old man saying that sounds ridiculous. But we're not going to get into the Dance of Death. That's a musical propaganda play. No, we're not. And then the poems he wrote with his friend Christopher Isherwood, we're not going to get into that. The Dog Beneath the Skin and The Ascent and The Front Turn. No, we're going to get tonight we're going to get into the Palais de Beaux-Arts Museum. Now check this out. This is a wonderful poem. That focuses on human suffering and tragedy and pain by contrasting the lives of those who suffer with those who do not. Now, if you've been through an art gallery or been to an opera, you know that these are the constant themes that we see. The struggle of Carmen in Bizet's work, or La Bohème, the poverty, utter poverty, and the dignity that you can find in those types of things. Auden is philosophical and conversational, so he combines close to observation with nonchalant musings. Isn't that beautiful? So the next time you are noticing something about a butterfly wing and it just triggers that nonchalant musing in you, write it down for me and send it. Just before the start of the Second World War, he wrote this poem. It signaled an important change in his life, the way he was expressing it. He left behind that political persona and began to develop what was much more of a spiritual one, and spiritual in nature. At the same time, he immigrated to the United States and abandoning England and Europe. Not considered cool at the time, but he did leave at the outbreak of the war just before and he was in Belgium for a while, and then he came to the United States. Considered cool, you can imagine. Here. Now, what do you hear in the lines? What do you hear in these lines? You tell me. I won't tell you. This is riveting stuff. You're walking through consider that you're walking through the galleries here. And the analysis tells you, if you look for an analysis of this work, it'll tell you more about the art that he's referring to, but he only speaks about one, Bruegel's Icarus, but you're walking through the gallery and your friend beside you says, about suffering, they were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth that always must be children who do not specially want it to happen. Skating on a pond at the edge of the wood, they never forget that even the dreadful martyrdom that must run its course, however, in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away, quiet leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him, it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get and sailed calmly on. Ever wondered about why things are the way they are in masonry? Some of the things need, most things about masonry come with very, very broad and detailed explanations. The meaning of words, for example, the meaning of terms. It's unique. It's a lexicon, just like it is in whatever work you're doing. You even though the words may be familiar, the usage is specific to the work, whether you're working in metallurgy or a laboratory or a classroom, or you're in service in some way, the language that you use is unique. And we know, although bureaucrats don't want us to acknowledge this, we know that in order to survive, we develop a gallows humor, not out of disrespect, but out of survival. From the outside, they bray at us. I mean, you're being disrespectful. My God, we're trying to survive what we put ourselves through, what we go through every single day at work. You know the type. But we all are striving to do our best to get by. Now imagine that doing that, what we don't talk about doesn't mean that we we're unconscious to these things. In order for us to keep these values, our values, healthy and influential, we need to be able to, we need to talk about them. And where I am, we've taken most of all of that. We've just opened the book on that. Then it's wonderful. It's taken whatever time it's taken, but it's appropriate. The amount of time has been necessary for us in our particular setting. Begin to describe why. Who knows? It's the fate. It's the alignment of the planets. Pick one. But it is what it is. We are fortunate. We are very fortunate. Now, this portion that we're getting into in the history, we're looking at 18th century stuff. Out of the influence of Grand Lodge, we know it was coming out of Britain, but this is particularly because of the cultural, financial, military advantage context. We're talking about the Netherlands here. It's not just random. This is where there was things happening, and ideas were being developed. And here we see some of the reasoning about politics. Some of the reason. What bearing could that have on us? Well, I mean, really, something happens on the other side of the planet, and it's significant. And just because, you know, as we heard, not knowing, how do you learn without knowing? If you don't know any of this, you don't learn anything from it. It does have a bearing if you look for it. And the other question is, what if it has a bearing and you're not paying attention? We are not paying attention. Check this. Think about this and tell me. The use of the term party is significant in this part of the history. Grand Lodge consistently used it against rebellious lodges. They form a party, is the way they put it. There was a politic. In the 1760s, the Grand Lodge, still quarreling with other lodges, accused a lodge in Utrecht, which Rousset, the fellow that we've been talking about, he was banished, and Rousset de Missy, he was banished. They wanted him out. This is like, I think, a predecessor, you know, an ancestor of Aleister Crowley, and still crawling with other lodges. So Rousset had set up his exile there in the early 1750s. Of being a party. He was accused. This is a party. This is influence. These are not just people that are meeting for their internal reasons. This has purpose about control. By then, however, the dispute with the Amsterdam Lodge had been settled. In 1759, remember, this is only decades after the establishment of a nascent governance structure. Not necessarily the philosophies of masonry. Come on now. In 1759, with the election of a new Grand Master, the dispute was buried, and a new constitution was granted to the Lodge Le Bien Ami. Do your own reading on that, if you choose. M-E-A-I-M-E-E. It, in turn, directed its members, the Lodge, to forget and leave aside all events of the past as they had never happened, to respect the highly noble and respectable Grand Master, and to consider all legitimate lodges of these countries as worthy fellows, members of the same body. Move on. Move on. A tenuous and fragile unity had been at least temporarily achieved. The other lodges were now permitted to have correspondence with the forgiven rebels, but Pierre Brunel, the old master Rousset had nominated as his replacement, still objected that the new leadership of Bien-Aimé was illegitimate and usurping. As late as the 1780s, Brunel appeared in the lodge and somewhat mysteriously presented it with the missing document, the original constitution, or a copy thereof, from the Grand Lodge of Scotland, dated 26 December 1755. Ah, shenanigans, eh? The lodge sealed it away in its archives. Throughout the 1760s, disputes over the legitimacy of one or another lodge, or over the right of a brother from one lodge to be admitted to another, continued to be commonplace. At this distance, the emotion generated by these disputes is hard to recreate. The threat to a lodge's honor, the issue of obedience to duly constituted authority, the yearning for harmony and respectability, not unlike today. These were real desires expressed in those words and emotively. When another lodge tried to settle dispute between Le Bien-Aimé and Grand Lodge, the mediator spoke about its desire, like in former times, to join hands and hearts fraternally together and to promote the construction of the respectable temple. Do you get it? You can see, the concern today, based on that history, it could happen. So we put in place guidelines. We also put in place and began to develop what we refer to as landmarks. A way not of punishment, because we can see you get into this kind of a spitting match, nobody benefit. Every makes us all look like fools. The exercise of authority, failure of leadership. Here, our landmarks are given to us not as dogma, and we're not a religion, my goodness, but as guidelines, a way of anticipating. Anticipating a problem downstream and going further and further to ensure that we reduce the risks of complications. We know we never can erase them. We know that. But we can reduce risk wherever we can. Again, none of it matters if we don't know it. None of it matters. So, the chirpy, cheery part is it's all there. And a lot, where I am, I'm sitting in this period of change. It's wonderful. Well, what I see going on where I am is this monochrome bursting into color. It's beautiful. I see things, people, fellows getting together and putting together programming and getting people to tune in, sharing ideas. It's wonderful. No, it's not. One size fits all. No, far from it. It's collecting and sharing and enjoying the variations and what brings it together and what keeps us content in brotherhood is the advantage of landmarks. This is from my humble beginnings, that they aren't and can't be effective. Our values, our principles aren't effective if they've been left to gather dust. because we're assuming, and that's where we're making a mistake, we're assuming they have relevance. Well, they can't. Do they have relevance? Well, that's an interesting question for us. Do they have relevance if we don't care about them? Do they have relevance if we don't even know that they exist? So I think in large ways, what we've experienced where I am, and in part where you are too, I'm sure this is not an unknown phenomena, is what happens when that knowledge isn't shared. Well, it's too much for one person. So if we need to have that conversation. The conversation about what determines expertise in masonry. And I think that's a fair kind of thing to use, don't you? Absolutely. The when we get around to it, we know that the one solution would be to review these values, review these landmarks. What are they? And I think at one point I've heard somebody explain to me 124 landmarks. It could be more. But they're not written down. Some Grand Lodges do write them down. Where I am, we don't, because there's fluidity to it, isn't there? It's never said, if you write them down, it's like anything else. You're limiting. If I give you a written down definition of your role in masonry, I'm limiting all the other possibilities, if I'm expecting that you're going to accept my definitions. Masonry has not done that. Where I am not done that. Now, that's not to say that there's a wrongness for other Grand Lodges that have a written codex, a written down. Those are perhaps the advantage of stereotypes. We use those landmarks. And it's not to limit, but to recognize that different cultures approach ideas in different ways, in unique ways. So we have variations, and the variation is emerging like this, beautiful. And with it comes this sense of there's an excitement because we can't tell the outcome. Determinists are mightily unhappy with this. They have to define the goal. Well, that is not, how far ahead can you project your thinking? Now you do that and you tell me, what's the art going to be like 100 years from now? What's the philosophy going to be like? How are we going to apply? What's it like and how we apply it? And what are the results? What are the benefits? What are the consequences? Do that. Have that conversation with us. And next week, come back. I'm toying with, come back. I hope you will. Help me understand what is going on with the people tuning in. Holy, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. It's like watch what you wish for, Graham, because it might come true. Well, I've wished for the program to go out around the world, and apparently it is. Dear me. There you go. And thanks for over the years for all the support from fellows like you. We're going to get out of here now, and I hope we get to see you again next week. Thanks, and commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. They're a treat. Bye for now. What? What? Thank you.